I'm going to be talking mainly about the Iliad, but I want to begin with a justly celebrated scene from the other epic, the one about the survivor from the war at Troy, who spends 10 years trying to get home to Ithaca and to his waiting wife, Penelope. Odysseus washes up on the island of Phaeacia. He is taken to the royal palace, feasted, and he listens to some songs sung by the blind bard Demodocus that it's hard not to take as, in some way, as an epitome of the bard Homer himself. Demodocus sings one of Odysseus' own famous feats, though not, as it happens, one we see or hear about in the Iliad itself. He sings the tale of how the Greeks finally captured Troy after 10 years and destroyed it through the great ruse of the wooden horse. As Odysseus listens to this, he does not rejoice, but we are told he melts and tears run down his cheeks. As a woman weeps, lying over the body of her dear husband, who fell fighting for her city and people, as he tried to beat off the pitiless day from city and children. She sees him dying and gasping for breath, and winding her body about him, she cries high and shrill, while the men behind her, hitting her with their spear butts on the back and the shoulders, force her up and lead her away into slavery, to have hard work and sorrow, and her cheeks are racked with pitiful weeping. Such were the pitiful tears Odysseus shed from under his brows. Now, to those who have read or heard the Iliad, this great simile of the bereaved, grief-stricken woman faced with a terrible future sounds very like Andromache, the wife of Hector and mother of Astyanax, of whom more anon. It's a tedious question to ask what a work of art is about. Hard to avoid sometimes. Insofar as it makes sense to try and answer it, you could say that the Odyssey is almost as much about war as its predecessor, the Iliad. The later epic is about war's aftermath, about the survivors, about memory, trauma, mourning, about the veterans' homecoming. The Iliad addresses the experience of frontline combat more directly, and there is plenty, more than enough, of lethal violence, panic, and horror in the Iliad. But this is not why it has survived for nearly 3,000 years, why it has been endlessly translated and interpreted, why it has inspired so much further new art or poetry. Poetry in the root sense of the word, making. The Iliad and the Odyssey have this in common, that they are about what it means to face death, and they are about how and why we tell stories and sing. Sing is the second word of the Iliad, meinen aide thea, literally wrath. Sing, goddess. Or, as Robert Fagles, whose translation I'll be relying on this evening, has it, rage, goddess, sing the rage of Peleus' son Achilles, murderous, doomed, that cost the Achaeans countless losses, hurling down to the house of death so many sturdy souls, great fighters' souls, that made their bodies carrion. Feasts for the dogs and the birds, and the will of Zeus was moving toward its end. Begin, muse, when the two first broken clash, Agamemnon, lord of men, and brilliant Achilles. There are many words and ideas here on which we could dwell. There is the rather special word for rage or wrath, normally associated only with the gods and not with human beings, for whose anger there are plenty of more ordinary and everyday words. a slightly special word, this opening word of the Iliad. But then Achilles is half god, the son not only of the mortal man Peleus, but the immortal sea nymph Thetis. And I want to come back to this strange and tragic little family unit. There is the word for countless in the second line, beyond number, immense in the root meaning of that word, beyond measurement. We get our word myriad from it, by the way. Enormity, you could say, is itself one of the subjects of the Iliad. Here is the challenge for the poet, for hearers, for readers, of sheer excess. That is what war is. Too much. Too many people. Too much suffering. Too many stories. Too many memories. Just too much to tell. I don't believe anybody who says they've sat down and read the Iliad at one sitting. Or if they did, there's something. Surely it's not possible. We could take the force from the outset of this contrast between the strong souls and the bodies that turn into carrion, those helpless bodies reduced to being food for the dogs and the birds. Eating and drinking will turn out to be hugely important in this poem. The gods do a lot of it, of course, and so do the men. On the one hand, these are crucial acts of sharing and exchange, rites of social solidarity, exemplary trust between hosts and guests. How apposite that we should be going on to dinner after this. Thank you, Edward. Marking the difference between culture and nature red in tooth and claw, between the human animal and the beasts to whose level we can so easily degenerate, of which more in a moment. But before we leave this little prelude, the most mysterious line, of course, is the line, and the will of Zeus was moving toward its end. That's an accurate representation of the imperfect tense in the original Greek, was moving towards its end. This offers comfort of sorts, that some kind of divine providence looms over the whole poem, just as there will be comforts to be had from the readiness of divinities of many different kinds and personality to intervene in human affairs, sometimes to listen to prayers and appeals, and others to ignore or reject them. Besides Zeus, there will be Apollo, Athena, Hera, Artemis, Poseidon, Ares, Aphrodite. Not just one, but many will. Many different ones, often in violent conflict, which makes this line, the will of Zeus, even more mysterious. Moving towards its end, but not getting there. The poem ends before the fall of Troy, so much so that a good recent translator of the poem, Stephen Mitchell, feels able to say that at the end of the Iliad, Homer gives Priam and Achilles a reprieve of infinite time. The great city of Troy still stands, forever poised on the brink of disaster. Andromache will never become a slave, nor will her child be hurled off the wall of Troy. Hecuba will see Hector's body come home as she desired. Priam will forever sit at the funeral feast, eating, drinking, and mourning over his fallen son to his heart's content. Achilles will sleep with his beloved Briseis forever. Really? It's hard to tell how provocative Mitchell is trying to be here. Those future tenses, will and will never, sound too simple, as does that glib, possibly deliberately glib phrase about Priam mourning his son to his heart's content. At the end of the Iliad, everyone and everything is still moving toward their ends, and that includes the will of Zeus. Let's go back to the beasts, the dogs and the birds, and cut to the poem's climax, or one of them. Achilles has speared Hector through the neck. The Trojans' champion lies at his feet on the point of death. Hector begs his killer to be allowed humane burial, not to be left to the dogs to be devoured. Not for the first time in the poem, Achilles is offered or promised princely gifts. The ransom that Hector knows his father and mother will offer in return for his corpse. Not for the first time, Achilles refuses to give up his inhuman anger and snarls down at his victim. Would to God my rage, my fury would drive me now to hack your flesh away and eat you raw. Such agonies you have caused me, your ransom. No man alive could keep the dog packs off you. The dogs and birds will rend you blood and bone. This savagery is not unique to Achilles. On the contrary, listen to Hecuba, Hector's mother, when her husband Priam proposes to go to Achilles, the man who has killed their son, and plead for his body. Are you out of your mind, she says to him. If he gets you in his clutches, sets his eyes on you, that savage, treacherous man, he'll show no mercy, no respect for your rights. Oh, would to God that I could sink my teeth in his liver, eat him raw. That would avenge what he has done to Hector. Well, of course, she doesn't eat him raw. Nor do the dogs and birds tear her son's corpse apart, because this shows the gods at their best. The gods are disposed to honour the distinction between human and bestial. Zeus is not pleased with Achilles' refusal to relent at this point. I think it's the first time in the poem where Zeus expresses a distinct negative opinion about Achilles. He says, that's wrong. For all the nightmare of grief that Hector's death brings to his loved ones, there is this beautiful consolation embodied in the magical preservation from harm or decay of any kind of Hector's corpse. The kindly god, young Hermes, tells Priam on the way to the great final confrontation with Achilles that despite all Achilles' efforts to desecrate the body, and God knows he tries, the gods have kept it safe and even healed it. Beautiful touch that to balance the rather horrific thing of not just Achilles but all the Greeks coming along and taking a go at Hector's corpse, stabbing it when he's already dead, the gods come along and heal all those wounds so that the body is beautiful by the time Priam receives it. One way of describing the Iliad would be that it tells a story about the loss of the difference between man and beast and the recovery of that distinction. You can say that it is about unmaking, about the collapse into savagery of its greatest warrior, Achilles, and his return to humanity right at the end. Is this what war is bound to do? In the thick of battle, how can you tell which side anyone is on? Look at this man going berserk in the fog of war, Diomedes, who seeks to take over Achilles' role as the greatest warrior amongst the Greeks in Achilles' absence. Diomedes, which side was the fighter on? You could not tell. Did he rampage now with the Trojans or the Argives? Argives, Greeks. Down the plain he stormed like a stream in spate, a routing winter torrent, sweeping away the dikes. Let me just glide in here a perspective supplied by an American clinical psychiatrist named Jonathan Shea, who has specialized in the treatment of combat trauma suffered by veterans from Vietnam. Shea is the author of two very fine, I think, very challenging books that read the two Homeric epics from the point of view of his own clinical experience, above all in listening to the stories that the vets have to tell, or indeed encouraging to tell their stories and get them listened to. Achilles in Vietnam, and then followed by Odysseus in America. And one of the things I like about these books is that, he uses Homer to provide insights into the experience of these real wounded soldiers, but he also has no qualms about using their experience to read Homer for insight and for critique, particularly when it comes to the Odyssey. He says, why are so many readers of the Odyssey so generous to its hero? From a GI's perspective, Odysseus is an irresponsible, near-lunatic leader who risks his men's lives at every twist and turn. He starts off from Troy with 12 ships full of men. How many of them does he successfully get home? None! This is not, a particularly good record, as they say. And there's something very refreshing about Shea's refusal to be impressed by things that more traditionally raised scholars rather gloss over. When Odysseus says, having lost another 500 men, he says, well, so we fared forward and death fell behind, and we took breath to grieve for our companions. And Shea won't let a moment like that go. He says, hold on a minute. How many men has this man just lost? Is this good enough? I like that. What kind of trust would you put in him if you were a GI? Would you be happy to be in Odysseus' troop? No. Others have pointed out that Odysseus is scarcely alone in this respect, as a failed leader of men, and in fact that it's an accusation that could be readily levelled at virtually all the leaders, the heroes, the heroic figures at Troy, who are supposed to be the shepherds of their flocks, a simile which is often regularly used of the leaders, shepherds of their flocks, to look after the sheep, that they fail to do so, even in the case of Hector. Well, as it turns out, Hecuba is wrong about Achilles, thank God. The distinction between friend and foe can be confused or overcome by other allegiances and loyalties, even if that is not easy. Consider this auspicious moment when two enemies agree not to pursue each other to the death. Again, this moment involves Diomedes. When we first see him, we've had a glimpse of him, he's like a wild animal or a force of nature, attacking, wounding everything in his path, including the gods. Those wonderful moments when Diomedes goes after Aphrodite and wounds her in the wrist, and she goes wailing home to mummy, I was going to say, to her mother up in Olympus. Wonderful moment. And he goes after Ares, and then, there comes a moment when he realizes this is not such a good idea. Well, the moment I want to point to is a moment that charts Diomedes' little education in these matters when he comes face to face with another Trojan warrior, in fact an ally from Lycia called Glaucus. And Diomedes has learnt enough sense at this moment to ask who he's about to kill before he does so, or to go at. Says, quite challenging, he says, tell me who you are, just in case you're a god. Of course, wholly unrealistic to be doing this in the midst of the battle, but never mind, that is the point when Glaucus, whom he challenges, goes into this long story about his family history, a very important story about his family history, not the kind of thing that you'd expect to happen in battle normally. And then you remember the famous and touching story of the football game on Christmas Day in World War I, in the first year of the war. So this man's name is Glaucus. He is the son of Hippolochus, the grandson of Bellerophon, and so on. But these names are important as he tells his story, because Diomedes recognizes some of them and realizes that their stories are intertwined because, hey, their grandfathers knew each other. Their grandfathers knew each other and played host and guest to each other. Crucial rites of hospitality throughout the Iliad. They played host and guest to each other and exchanged gifts of guest friendship. So Diomedes recognized. But the most important thing about this is, in a sense, not the details. It is the fact of the storytelling itself, that Glaucus tells this long story about his family history, and Diomedes listens. Why? Because the words, or at least the story out of which the words are made, are a gift being exchanged between the teller and the listener. It is through, I said, one of the things these epics are about telling stories. Why we do it? It is through the telling and the listening to these stories that we recognize what we have, or could have, or might have in common. But the bit I'm going to play you is when Glaucus just starts off. Before he gets going, he returns wonderfully to Diomedes, the son of Tydeus, high-hearted son of Tydeus. Why ask about my birth? Like the generation of leaves, the lives of mortal men. Now the wind scatters the old leaves across the earth. Now the living timber bursts with the new buds, and spring comes round again. And so with men. As one generation comes to life, another dies away. But about my birth, if you'd like to learn it well, first, last, and here's my story. It gets going. This is a simile that we hear elsewhere, comparing the lives of mortals with the leaves on the trees, the cycle of seasonal death and rebirth that may guarantee the continuation of the tree or the species, though not of the individual leaf. Most memorably, I think, in Book 21, when the gods are at war with each other, and Poseidon challenges Apollo. Poseidon says to Apollo, "Come on, put your fists up. All the other gods are fighting, so let's fight together." And Apollo, rather magnificently, declines. He says, "But the distant deadly archer volleyed back, 'God of the earthquake, Poseidon, you'd think me hardly sane if I fought with you for the sake of wretched mortals, like leaves, no sooner flourishing, full of the sun's fire, feeding on earth's gifts, than they waste away and die. Stop. Call off this skirmish of ours at once. Let these mortals fight themselves to death." Now, so far I've been stressing the confusion between humans and beasts, but of course the other great distinction that gets blurred in this poem, much more so than in the Odyssey, is the distinction between men and gods. Achilles is only the most salient of the many heroes of mixed race, human beings with immortal blood in their veins or cells in their genes, who must come to terms with their own mortality and relinquish their kinship with the gods. And this is quite important too, though less obvious. The gods too have to come to terms with this and leave human beings to their fate, as Apollo does here, as Zeus does at an important moment when he faces the mortality of his own son, Sarpedon, who's on the brink of being killed by Patroclus. And Zeus says, I could save it, couldn't I? I wonder if I should do that. It's a very important moment when he pauses. I mean, there are moments when other gods and goddesses do intervene, Aphrodite to save her boy Aeneas. But Zeus pauses here, reflects, and gets some sharp advice from his wife, Hera, and realizes that he has to let this mortal son go. If not now, then sometime. So why not now? Sarpedon, this beloved son of Zeus, and Glaucus, or Glaucus, as we've just seen, are cousins, as it happens. And in thinking of himself and Diomedes and the rest of humanity as leaves on the tree, Glaucus is giving emphatic expression to what joins us together and distinguishes us so sharply from the gods. I said that both epics represent men facing death, and it is men, to be sure, directly rather than women. Here is a thought about war as a near-death experience, a euphemism, of course, but then war makes all language more or less of a euphemism. Or if not euphemism, then an approximation, a likeness. The famous Homeric similes are not casual adornments. They are explicit instances of something that goes on the whole time in this poem, in likening or mimicking or imitating the way a man speaks, runs, the way he sounds and looks like to others. Famous similes like the dying man whose head falls over like a poppy. It's the one that everyone remembers, Gorgythion, who, when he dies, goes like this, says, like a poppy. Let me call your attention to a kind of moment or experience at which simile is particularly memorable. It is to do with nearliness, if I may coin the word. That's to say, when someone nearly receives a fatal wound and narrowly escapes. It has been pointed out by Jonathan Shea, amongst others, that Homer's description of war is in one respect hugely inaccurate, or at least misleading, because his warriors die so cleanly and promptly. They do not suffer in agony for hours or days, a major reality of warfare until quite recently, no morphine. All the more precious and telling, I think, are the moments when warriors narrowly avoid lethal injury. Menelaus, for example, struck by an arrow from Pandarus. But you, Menelaus, the blessed deathless gods did not forget you. Zeus's daughter, the queen of fighters, Athene, first of all. She reared before you, skewed the tearing shaft, flicking it off your skin as quick as a mother flicks a fly from her baby, sleeping softly. So near and yet so far, one might say, of this simile, the peaceful, protective world of mother and child, a world away from that of death on the battlefield? Perhaps not. An alternative world that war brings constantly to mind, exciting the longing for it, the nostalgia for it. This leads me to a thought about alternatives, or two-ness. At the climax of the whole epic, a man is running for his life, chased by his killer, round the walls of Troy, past a wild fig tree, down the wagon trail, until they reach the clear running springs where whirling Scamander rises up from its double wellsprings, bubbling strong, and one runs hot, the steam goes up around it, drifting thick as if fire burned at its core. But the other, even in summer, gushes cold as hail or freezing snow, or water chilled to ice. Wonderful that the poem should pause or suspend things at this moment of high drama. The passage goes on then to recall the days when the women of Troy did their washing in the wonderful stone basins, fueled by these springs. It is a moment of respite, a moment of memory of another world and time, which then makes the return to the here and now all the more sharp. Past these raced, one escaping, one in pursuit, and the one who fled was great, but the one pursuing greater, even greater. Their pace mounting in speed, since both men strove not for a sacrificial beast or oxhide trophy, prizes runners fight for, no. They raced for the life of Hector, breaker of horses. In other words, this is a kind of anti-simile. War is like sport, is like war. A very common analogy, of course, with some truth in it. But war is not like an athletics match, or even the Premier League, or the Six Nations, or the Rugby World Cup, when it comes to the final result, the prize of life or death itself. Just as those two wellsprings are in themselves quite distinct and separate, as are, more famously, in the great climactic fable invoked by Achilles in the scene with Priam about the two urns or jars of Zeus. This is Achilles at his most seer-like moment, where he sees and speaks with the kind of authority that we don't hear from him until now. And he says to Priam, "There are two great jars that stand on the floor of Zeus's halls and hold his gifts, our miseries one, the other blessings. When Zeus, who loves the lightning, mixes gifts for a man, now he meets with misfortune, now good times in turn. When Zeus dispenses gifts from the jar of sorrows only, he makes a man an outcast. Brutal, ravenous hunger drives him down the face of the shining earth, stalking far and wide, cursed by gods and men. So with my father Peleus." Slightly ambiguous, remember. People often misremember this, that they think that we get either blessings from the good jar or curses from the bad jar, but that's not what it says. It says that when Zeus is kind to you, he gives you gifts from both the bad jar and the good jar. And it's only if you're really unlucky you get things from the really bad jar only. But it is, just pause there, because it's often misremembered. Just for a moment, he says, "So with my father Peleus," it's unclear which of the examples he's about to say. And then it turns out that Peleus, his father, is a great exemplar of the mixed life, of blessings. What glittering gifts the gods rained down from the day that he was born. Excelled all men in wealth and pride of place, lorded it over the myrmidons, and mortal that he was, they gave the man an immortal goddess for a wife. Yes, but even on him the father piled hardships. No powerful race of princes born in his royal halls. Only a single son he fathered, doomed at birth, cut off in the spring of life. And I give the man no care as he grows old, since here I sit in Troy, far from my fatherland. A grief to you, speaking to Priam, a grief to all your children." So, alternatives, and then there is, at the very heart of the poem, the great alternative with which Achilles himself has been faced, told by his mother, "There are two ways I might die. If I stay here and keep on fighting around the city of Troy, I can never go home, but my glory will live forever. But if I return in my ships to my own dear country, my glory will die, but my life will be long and peaceful." This is a wonderful moment in the poem, when it looks as though he's going to take that second choice. He's going to go home and forfeit the glory. And for a very important phase in the poem, that looks like what he's going to do. And then there is the great alternative posed by the two warriors, by Achilles and Hector. And I want now, for the next few minutes, to thread a comparison between not just the two warriors, but the two families surrounding these warriors at the poem's center. First, there is the half-immortal Achilles, as I've said, son of a divine mother, the sea nymph Thetis, and the mortal father, Peleus, king of Thea. Achilles is a man without a wife, and perhaps without a child. And I just want to pause on this here. Later legend, possibly simultaneous legend, other legends, know of Achilles' son Neoptolemus, or Pyrrhus, as in Hamlet, the Pyrrhus there, of a son who was raised in Achilles' absence and never seen by his father. We know of this son from the Odyssey, from Book 11, when Odysseus goes down to the underworld and meets all his old comrades now, including Achilles, who says to Odysseus, "How did my son do? Did he ever get to Troy? What did he do?" And Odysseus is able to say, "Oh, he did very, very well. He helped us capture Troy." And Achilles is thrilled and strides off across the field of Asphodel in the underworld. And then there is, any of you who are doing part two English should have read, I hope, Sophocles' magnificent tragedy, Philoctetes, in which Achilles' son is an absolutely central character. But in the Iliad itself, there is only one reference of questionable authenticity, it seems to me, in Book 19. When Achilles is mourning over the corpse of his beloved comrade Patroclus, and he says nothing worse could have happened than the death of his beloved comrade, not even the death of my father, he says, who must now be shedding hot tears in faraway fear, missing his son, me. And then someone has added, and this is from Robert Fables, or the death of my dear son, reared for me in Scyros, if Prince Neoptolemus is still among the living. But I think it's very hard, in the logic of the poem, I don't want to hear that. In fact, in the most recent translation I've been reading by Stephen Mitchell, he omits these lines. And that feels to me to be imaginatively right, if one can say so, as it were, back to Homer, though over the thousands of years. I think those lines shouldn't be there. And my guess and my feeling, my instinct, is that they are an interpolation. Who wrote Homer? Somebody stuck those lines in because they knew the story from elsewhere, but it doesn't belong here. It does not belong here. Achilles, the logic of it is that he should be wifeless and childless here. To stress the wonderful contrast with the fully human family in Troy, of Hector, with his wife Andromache, their little boy Astyanax, father Priam, mother Hecuba, even sister Cassandra. So let's just follow this for a moment or two and consider the first magical scene in Book 1, when Achilles has given Briseis up to Agamemnon, and he goes off, as he does so often, along the seashore, slipping away from his companions, sits down on the beach of the heaving grey sea and scans the endless ocean. Reaching out his arms again and again, he prayed to his dear mother, "Mother, you gave me life, short as that life will be, so at least Olympian Zeus, thundering up on high, should give me honour. But now he gives me nothing. Atreus' son Agamemnon, for all his far-flung kingdoms, the man disgraces me, seizes and keeps my prize. He tears her away himself." So he wept and prayed, and his noble mother heard him, seated near her father, the old man of the sea and the salt-green depths. Suddenly, up she rose from the churning surf like mist, and settling down beside him as he wept, stroked Achilles gently, whispering his name, "My child, why in tears? What sorrow has touched your heart? Tell me, please. Don't harbour it deep inside you. We must share it all." Good mother. just like that, suddenly. This is one of Homer's favourite kind of adverbs, suddenly, immediately, instantly, when the gods are just there before you've even expected them. Note that gesture, the comforting touch. She strokes her son. It's a gesture that will be repeated in Book 24, how alive your ears have to be in this enormous poem. From Book 1 to Book 24, when she comes again, this time armed with Zeus's command, you must give the body of Hector up. And again she arrives and repeats this gesture, stroking him gently. A good mother, she is always so sad, always grieving in advance, always remembering the future, her mortal son's end. Such sadness at this poem's core in the division between the human and the divine, and such pathos at the moments when they come so nearly together. And Achilles' father, her husband, Peleus, growing old, alone, back home in Phthia, long abandoned by his wife. So, let's move from here to the famous family scene in Troy in Book 6, the father and mother and son all together. Andromache begs Hector not to fight. Achilles, she says, killed my whole family, my father, Aetion, my seven brothers, and my mother's died too. So you, Hector, you are my father now, my noble mother, a brother too. And you are my husband, young and warm and strong. Pity me, please. Wonderful lines which Aeschylus seems to remember when Electra greets her brother Orestes with a very similar formula. You are everything to me. You are father and brother and husband. And Hector responds magnificently, and I'm going to quote this at length. All this weighs on my mind too, dear woman. But I would die of shame to face the men of Troy and the Trojan women trailing their long robes if I would shrink from battle now, a coward. Nor does the spirit urge me on that way. I've learnt it all too well, to stand up bravely, always to fight in the front ranks of Trojan soldiers, winning my father great glory, glory for myself. For in my heart and soul, I also know this well. The day will come when sacred Troy must die. Priam must die, and all his people with him. Priam, who hurls a strong ash spear. Even so, and this is where it becomes astonishing, it is less the pain of the Trojans still to come that weighs me down. Not even of Hecuba herself, or King Priam, or the thought that my own brothers, in all their numbers, all their gallant courage, may tumble in the dust, crushed by enemies. That is nothing. Nothing beside your agony, when some brazen Argive hails you off in tears, wrenching away your day of light and freedom. Then, far off in the land of Argos, you must live, labouring at a loom, at another's beck and call. And a man may say, who sees you streaming tears, there's the wife of Hector, the bravest fighter they could field, those stallion-breaking Trojans, long ago when the men fought for Troy. So he will say, and the fresh grief will swell your heart once more, widowed, robbed of the one man strong enough to fight off your day of slavery. The scene goes on memorably. Their little boy, Astyanax, is scared by the plume on his father's helmet. The father and mother laugh indulgently, though the boy is right to be scared of the future that lies ahead of him, represented by that helmet. But they laugh indulgently at his premature terror. The father prays for the boy's future, his future glory, picks him up and puts him in the arms of his dear wife, who smiles and weeps at the same time. And moved with pity by Andromache's tears and smiles, Hector stroked her gently with the same formula we have already heard. Here is another weeping woman confronting the mortality of the man she loves. Now it is the man stroking the woman gently, though this woman's tears are warmer than Thetis's. A particular word in there to stress that Andromache weeps warm tears, as one can't help but feel that the scene in Thetis does not. They're different. We could look ahead from this scene to the one at the end of book 22, an almost unbearable moment, which I will move over lightly. When Hector has died and when Andromache gives vent to her grief and the future that lies ahead for their little boy now, just as Hector had imagined the terrible future lying ahead for his wife, so she now imagines the terrible future ahead for Astyanax and for all boys, all children, orphaned by war or any catastrophe that robs them of their father's protection. She imagines, looking ahead, the little boy going out to his old father's comrades, tugging at their sleeves, being given something to drink, enough to wet his lips, not quench his thirst. But then some bully, with both his parents living, beats him from the banquet, fists and abuses flying. "You, get out, you've got no father feasting with us here." And the boy, sobbing, trails home to his widowed mother. It's an extremely painful kind of scene. And again, any of you know your Sophocles may think of that fine, very painful moment in Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus Rex, when Oedipus starts imagining the future for his children, his little girls in this case, or what life will be like ahead for them. And again, it's to do with this sense of them not being welcome at all the children's parties any longer. One of the endless wonders of the Iliad is the way it makes connections and comparisons over its huge extent, or at least ignites these connections in the mind of the attentive reader or listener. I've pointed to a couple of occasions now in which characters find themselves imagining what the future will be like for someone else that they love, whom they love. And here's another one, important I think, because it involves Achilles himself, imagining what life will be like for his mother after his own death. For she is a goddess, and her grief will be eternal. "If only you could have stayed at home with the sea nymphs," Achilles says to his mother, "and Peleus had taken a mortal woman as bride. But as it is, your heart will be filled with endless grief for the death of your child." And the word for endless there in the Greek is that same word we heard in line 2 of the whole poem, the word for countlessness or immeasurability, the word we get myriad from. Endless grief you will suffer. "If only you could have stayed at home. And Peleus has taken a mortal woman as bride, and you..." Ah, but here there is an important bit of backstory that I think all listeners to the Iliad will have known, whereby Thetis was sought by Zeus and Poseidon until they heard the prophecy that Thetis was doomed to give birth to a son greater than his father. At which point, the sexual ardour of Zeus and Poseidon unaccountably flinched, and they thought, perhaps not, and instead married Thetis off to a mortal man, Peleus. What a terrible fate to be Thetis, Achilles' mother. What a terrible fate to be Peleus, his father, whom we never see in the poem, but whose image, as we say, the father of Achilles, is woven deep into it from its opening lines, but who rises, this father, into increasing prominence towards its end, as Achilles increasingly recognizes his own mortality and recognizes his deep kinship with his mortal father and with all other mortal fathers and sons. Peleus, I won't go into it, but the ways Peleus figures in the poem are very beautiful. He's particularly associated with offering refuge to refugees, not just refugees, but refugees who have committed homicide, accidentally, it's true. But he's associated with a generosity, Patroclus being the third in a sequence of such refugees. But I must move towards an end, and that means coming to, arguably, the climax of the Iliad, when Priam and Achilles come together in book 24. It is, of course, deeply wrong, this scene, in that this is the wrong father and son, the wrongest father and son you could imagine. A father seeking the body of his own son from the man who has killed him, and asking Achilles to remember his own father. That's Priam's, I was going to say brilliant, but as if there was calculation to it. He knows that this is the only way to persuade Achilles, to remind him of his own mortality. Those words, remember your own father, stirred within Achilles a deep desire to grieve for his own father. Taking the old man's hand, he gently moved him back. The opposite of stroking, it suddenly occurs to me. And overpowered by memory, both men gave way to grief. Priam wept freely for man-killing Hector, throbbing, crouching before Achilles' feet, as Achilles wept himself, now for his father, now for Patroclus once again, and their sobbing rose and fell throughout the house. As I say, these poems have inspired not only translation, reading, interpretation, but also astonishing and often very fine new works. I just want to leave you, as I started with Odysseus, to leave you with an Odyssean image rather than an Iliadic one, but one which somehow bridges the two poems. Recent years, for example, have seen a very fine reimagining of Book 24 by the Australian novelist David Malouf, called The Ransom. Malouf says that he was inspired as a 9-year-old boy in primary school by being read the Iliad by an inspiring teacher. Alice Oswald has recently issued a well-regarded book of poems based on the Iliad called Memorial. But I want to leave you with just a very short extract from a very fine work of fiction, I hesitate to call it novel, by Zachary Mason, called The Lost Books of the Odyssey, which I strongly recommend. Penelope's Elegy. Odysseus set foot on Ithaca, trembling with wrath, his spear poised to fly through the heart of the first man unwise enough to cross him. He passed unopposed up to his old hall, where, instead of enemies, he found his kinsmen turning to face him with wide eyes, exclaiming in wonder. He first thought it was a war cry and nearly slew them. They drew him in among them, touching and praising him, all astonishment and delight, except for Penelope, whose face had been the ground for the figure of his dreams, hardly aged and oddly quiet, lingering alone at the back of the crowd. He pushed his way through to her and reached out to touch her cheek, but she evaded him, and the crowd looked away, suddenly quiet, and Odysseus was aware that he had blundered. The next day they showed him her grave. For the rest of his time on Ithaca, Odysseus avoided looking at her as she lingered in his home, staring out of the window and idly running her fingertips over familiar things. He mastered his desire to seize her legs and kiss her thighs and hands, for he knew she would turn to ash and shadow as soon as he touched her. And moreover, nothing is more disgraceful than to acknowledge the presence of